Good morning, and I'd like to welcome you to the Migration Policy Institute. My name is Mark Rosenblum, and I'm a senior policy analyst here at MPI. And today's briefing, Lessons from the 2007 Legal Arizona Workers Act, is an opportunity to discuss the research that the Public Policy Institute of California has done on that issue. And this report is some of the first research that has analyzed outcomes of the Arizona law. So we're excited to be helping PPIC release it. The PPIC research on the Legal Arizona Workers Act relates to a lot of work that MPI has done on E-Verify, including a policy insight that we published last month, and on state and local enforcement efforts, including a report that we recently released on the 287G program, and additional forthcoming research we have on sort of the broader enforcement landscape. It also overlaps with MPI's research on migration and labor market outcomes during the Great Recession. And we have some research, including a report that we published last year with the BBC that studies the impact of the recession on international migration in the US and in several European countries. And I think the PPIC paper more generally is important because it's one of the first systematic efforts to examine migration and labor market outcomes in the state that's, you know, ground zero in the U.S. immigration debate and state-level enforcement efforts. So to the extent that states are laboratories of democracy on immigration issues, and we can debate how much they are and how much they should be, we now have a couple of years of experience of how that's playing out in Arizona. And this is one of the first efforts empirically to examine what's going on and to draw some lessons. So I think it's a very important paper. And again, we're pleased to be giving PPIC a forum to discuss it. So you can find MPI's related work out in the hallway and on our website at www.migrationpolicy.org. And you can find PPIC's report on their website, www.ppic.org. We're very pleased to have with us today PPIC research fellows Sarah Bone and Magnus Lofstrom joining us, and thank them for traveling so far. As Magnus pointed out yesterday, with daylight savings time, it's actually like 5 a.m. on their body clocks, so y'all should go easy on them. And after they present their report, we'll have some comments from former Congressman Bruce Morrison, former Congressman from Connecticut, former chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee, former member of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform, easily one of the country's leading experts on these issues, and so it's a great honor to have him here with us. You have their bios on your chairs, so I won't spend more time talking about their accomplishments and research backgrounds, but please take a look. We have a nice-sized audience for having a real conversation afterwards, so I'll try to keep to our clock and have time for discussion. I want to remind you that this event is being video recorded and live streamed, so any questions or comments will be, you know, broadcast to the world, so have that in mind. I also want to mention some upcoming events that we have, and you've got on your chair. We are involved in a couple of events this week, this weekend at the Kennedy Center that you've got announcements about. And then we also have upcoming events on the situation of Colombian refugees in Panama and Ecuador, and then our Immigration Law and Policy Conference on April 26th. So take a look at announcements there and information on our website. And you can also get video from today's event on our website as well. So with that, let me pass it to Magnus Lofstrom, and thank you again. And
thanks, Mark. And let me thank MPI for giving us this opportunity to come here and share with you our most recent immigration research. And thank you guys for coming here this morning. So the research report that I'll be talking about today is called Lessons from the 2007 Legal Arizona Workers Act. And this is joint work with Sarah Bone, as Mark pointed out, and also with Steve Raphael, who is professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And I also want to gratefully acknowledge that this research was supported with funding from the Russell Sage Foundation. So let me begin by telling you what I'm going to be doing for the next 20, 25 minutes. So I want to start off by talk a little bit about some background and give you the context that this piece of legislation came about and overall state-level legislation on unauthorized immigration. And then I'm going to turn to a brief discussion about how empirically we've gone about addressing this issue, trying to evaluate what are the impacts of the law in question here. And there are some issues and complications and difficulties and hurdles to get over in order to draw some inference from the data. And we're going to be focusing on two outcomes in this research that are directly related to the objectives of the legislation. And so we're going to focus on population effects and employment effects. And then I'm going to wrap up with the conclusions, not too surprisingly. So I don't think it's a very controversial statement to say that federal policies are ineffective in addressing unauthorized immigration in the U.S. And some evidence of this can be seen in just the data and the number of unauthorized immigrants. So in the just since the years immediately after 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, we've seen the unauthorized immigrant population grow from about 3 million to around 11 million now in the most recent estimates. And I think it's quite clear to most that really jobs are the primary draw for unauthorized immigrants. And this is in spite of what ERCOT, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, actually introduced. They introduced employer sanctions against knowingly hiring unauthorized immigrants. But it really appears that federal efforts and the federal enforcement of these sanctions and ERCA in general have been ineffective. There have been a number of strategies to deal with this over time. We've seen, for example, Social Security Administration's no match letters. We've seen the highly publicized ICE raids, read a lot about that in the papers when those are taking place. And more recently, it's more of a audit effort that the current administration is pursuing in addressing this. But overall, been rather ineffective. The numbers speak to that. And one of the facts is that employer sanctions have rarely been enforced, employer sanctions that came about from ERCA. We've seen a little bit of an uptick in that recently with these audit efforts. But in different development, a different strategy, and one action that the federal government has taken is developing the E-Verify program. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with the E-Verify program, but let me just briefly describe what it is. So E-Verify program is an online system that allows employers to use the newly hired employees' information from the I-9 form to check it against the Social Security Administration's database for identification to verify that that is indeed the individual, that the information given matches up, and that's the person then who they're saying they are, just based on things like Social Security and name, for example. And then it's checked against the Department of Homeland Security's database if that individual is authorized to work in the U.S. And I think there are a large number of people who believe that this is a pretty promising development, that the program itself is promising in addressing the employment of unauthorized immigration, at least. But the program is mostly voluntary. There is no national implementation except federal contractors are required to use the E-Verify program. So given all these factors, it really isn't surprising that states have reacted. States have reacted, and they're passing legislation against the hiring of unauthorized immigrants. And one very common feature of these legislations is the some form of E-Verify mandate. And what I'm showing here in the map that you see are different actions taken by states, where the darker shade is intended to indicate that more restrictive legislation, and the darkest that we see in four of these states indicate that there is a universal E-Verify mandate, that all employers are required to use E-Verify for all new hires. And those four states are Arizona, Utah, South Carolina, and Mississippi. The first state that did implement these universal E-Verify mandate was Arizona. And it is the fact that Arizona was the first state to do so in introducing the Legal Arizona Workers Act of 2007. It was passed in 2007 and enacted in 2008. It is the time that that has passed on since then that allows us an opportunity to perform this first evaluation of what are the outcomes of this type of law. And, of course, as well as Arizona having a sizable unauthorized immigrant population. I should point out that this, the law is focusing on employers, and this is not the controversial SB 1070 that I'm sure we've read about in the papers that focuses on the unauthorized immigrants themselves. The objective behind the law was really to make Arizona a less attractive labor market for unauthorized immigrants, and as well to improve labor market outcomes for legal competing workers. The requirements of the law, like I said, it includes an E-Verify mandate for all employers to check, using the federal government's E-Verify program to check work authorization for all new hires that have been hired since January 1st of 2008. The sanction or the law also includes penalties. So there's state-level employer sanctions introduced in this legislation. And for a first offense, it's a business license suspension. And for a second offense, it's a business license revocation. So these are pretty stiff sanctions. But to date, they really have few penalties that have been imposed. And we can only find three firms that have been received a business license suspension. So relatively few sanctions that have been imposed. But quite differently, when we look at E-Verify, the enrollment in E-Verify has been sharply increasing since the legislation. And Arizona now has the largest number of employers who are enrolled in the E-Verify program. And it went from a couple of hundred in 2005 to about 38,000 in 2010. So we have a high degree of enrollment compliance in E-Verify in Arizona. So this is important because when we're going to look at the impact of the Illegal Arizona Workers Act, ELAWA, we really think that we're picking up the effects of this E-Verify mandate. Okay? So the sanctions really, like I said, have not been imposed hardly at all, actually. So before I get into how we're going to what we're doing here, let me just give you what our key findings are here. We find that Arizona did achieve its goal of reducing the unauthorized immigrant population. The legislation also reduced employment of unauthorized immigrants. But there's also some evidence of an unintended consequence. And it might be that as a result of this law, there's a growth in informal employment as measured by an increase in self-employment. I'm going to come back to talking a little bit more about why this is possibly an area of concern as well. So as we go along, I get back to that important point. All right, so let me move on to talking a little bit about our empirical strategy here. And what we're want to do here is, what I'd like to do is talk about how we pinpoint LAWA's effect. Okay, so this is, as I said before, a pretty challenging thing to do. So I think it's worth talking about this for a few minutes. So the way we're doing this is we're going to compare outcomes In Arizona, the outcomes, as I said before, that we're going to focus on are employment and populations. We're going to compare these outcomes in Arizona to outcomes in states that did not pass such laws. Okay, so we can look at before and after in Arizona, before and after the legislation was passed, and then we can compare that to before and after in states that did not pass pass that type of legislation. So the question is then, of course, well, how are you going to pick these states that you're going to compare Arizona to that are going to represent, you know, a counterfactual here? So the strategy is really to select states that have similar population and employment characteristics and trends as Arizona. So that's really the objective here, is try to find those states that really can represent what would have happened in Arizona if Arizona did not pass the legislation. Okay, that's how we're going to be able to pinpoint what the effects are. And there are a couple of approaches to that. One is more the traditional, maybe the more obvious one, is to focus on the bordering regions and use that as a comparison area. And so we do that. In one of our approaches, we use Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and not all of California. We think coastal California might be different from Arizona, but we use inland California. Okay? So we are saying that that's one way that we can represent what would have happened in Arizona were it not for the law being passed. Another approach is a data-driven search. And all the results that I'm going to be presenting today are really based on this data-driven search instead of just relying on the bordering regions. And here it's really trying to use the data to see what states really match up the best based on their trends in employment and population prior to the legislation being passed. So the data is then going to tell us, okay, these are the states that really look the same before 2007 and can then represent what would have happened in Arizona after the if the legislation would not have been passed. Another issue that we have to deal with is data, of course. Okay, so there really is no suitable data where we have information where we can actually identify individuals as being unauthorized. So what we have to do is we have to draw unauthorized population information indirectly. So we're going to be using, primarily for the results that I'm showing you here, will be based on the current population survey. And our strategy is basically to define groups that have different shares of unauthorized immigrants in them. And what we're going to be using is then previous research that gives us some idea of what the characteristics of the unauthorized population, what those are in Arizona. And in Arizona, the unauthorized population is most likely to be non-citizen, obviously foreign-born, and then they're going to be Hispanic. So using those three criteria, we're going to define this group as being a group that contains individuals who are likely unauthorized. And we estimate that about 90% of this group are unauthorized. So it's a high proportion there. Okay, so that's one way. But we can also define groups that really shouldn't include any unauthorized immigrants. For example, individuals who report that they're naturalized Hispanics, they represent a group that really shouldn't contain any unauthorized immigrants. And we can compare then the outcomes of these groups as well to further give us information about whether what we find in the data is really driven by the legislation or some other overall trends. The last but very important issue that we have to address here is the role of the Great Recession. The legislation, as I said, it was passed in 2007 and it was enacted in January 1st of 2008. It coincides with this recession. And we want to make sure that what we're picking up isn't really driven by the recession itself. Okay? So the idea then is, of course, that these comparison states are really going to capture what the recession did to Arizona and that they are also looking very similar. So we want to make sure that these comparison states look similar in terms of what the recession did to them, and then giving us that information to suggest that it's not really, what we find is not driven by the recession. But it is possible that Arizona was especially hurt by the recession. We know that this is a housing-related recession, and we want to take a look at that. Looking at the data, what we do see is that, yes, employment in Arizona did suffer greatly, but it didn't suffer worse than it did in comparison states. Okay, so the figure that I'm showing you here now is for construction. And the reason we're picking construction here is because that's one of the most important industries, the most relevant industries with respect to the recession. As I said, it was a housing-related recession. But also from the perspective of unauthorized immigrants. It is an industry that had a large number of unauthorized immigrants working in it. And as you see in this graph here, we find the same trends in Arizona as we do in inland California and in these bordering states. So we really don't think that what we're going to be picking up here based on this is going to be due to the recession, okay? That what we're doing is going to pick up something other than the recession, and we believe that this is going to be the Arizona law. Okay, so let me move on to see then what do we find using this statistical approaches in the data. So let's start off with the population effects. And actually, let's start off by looking at what the estimates of the unauthorized population in Arizona, what they are. So what we see then is that there was a substantial decline in the unauthorized population 2008-2009, okay? And that in Arizona, the drop in the unauthorized population was much greater than it was in, for example, California or the country as a whole. It was about twice as high. The data, the graph that I'm showing here is based on data from the Department of Homeland Security. If we would have instead relied on estimates from the Pew Hispanic Center, these differences would have been even greater. So there's some indication here, but just looking at what the estimate of the unauthorized population, what they are, that there's something specific to Arizona. Of course, there are a number of factors that could have driven this. This isn't really sufficient to say that this is what the legislation has done. So let's move on to what our empirical approach tells us then happened in Arizona. So what I'm showing here is a graph of what the share of the foreign-born population is in Arizona and in the comparison states from 1998 to 2009. And what you see is that Arizona matches up really well with the comparison states before the legislation. So the comparison states are as seen in the dashed line, and Arizona is the solid line.
I mean, we're mixing foreign-born and immigrants, and confused, you know, the definitions can change, so I'm not quite sure.
Okay, so this is, so when I say foreign-born and immigrants, I mean the same thing. So I define immigrants.
Does that mean it means that anyone that's a non-citizen at that point?
They may be a citizen as well. They could be naturalized. I'm simply showing what the share of the foreign-born immigrant population in Arizona at this point. So this, right. That's all that is in this particular picture right now. I'm going to move on and show more specifically what we have in just. This also illustrates what is. You see the same kind of patterns before the legislation, and then starting in 2007, you see a divergent pattern. You see a decline in Arizona of the foreign-born population. Do not see in those comparison states. Okay? But moving on to more specifically the likely unauthorized group or the non-citizen Hispanic group in Arizona, we see the same pattern, but we also see that what drives the post-legislation outcome, the share, foreign-born share in Arizona, is driven by non-citizen Hispanics. Okay? And we see, again, we see these very similar patterns in the years prior to the legislation, and in 2007, we see a sharp decline. Okay. If we move on and look at the naturalized Hispanics, so this is a group that presumably does not include any unauthorized immigrants. We do not see this pattern. We see that it matches up what happened in Arizona before the legislation very well with the comparison states, but it does so after legislation. So the drop in the immigrant population in the that we see in Arizona is driven by the drop in the non-citizen Hispanics. Okay. So then putting some numbers to what these graphs are saying, we use our approach, let's call it difference and difference approach, to generate some magnitude of what these figures actually mean. And what we find is that the unauthorized population fell 17% due to the legislation. And this is measured as the decline among the non-citizen Hispanics. Okay, so I think it's important to keep that in mind, that that's when we're talking about our estimates of the unauthorized population, what we're talking about is the drop in the non-citizen Hispanics, a group that contains a high proportion of unauthorized immigrants. And this is equivalent to a drop that is due to the legislation of about 92,000 in the years 2008-2009. We do not find any convincing evidence that any other groups experienced this kind of decline in Arizona. So there's no statistically significant declines among naturalized population. That was what we saw in the graph, or any other group. And then also, if we look at more specifically some groups, we find that what's driving this, the strongest effects are really among the working age population of men, so those between 16 and 45. We also find other evidence that that is consistent with what we see in the population drop. So we're also looking at the housing market and the rental vacancy market in Arizona, and we see that this population drop is also reflected in the rental housing market. So what we have here is data on rental vacancy rates in Arizona and the comparison states. So using the same method as I mentioned before, and we see that Arizona matches up quite well with the comparison states in the years prior to 2007 when the law was passed, and then you start to see a divergent pattern where a substantially higher rental vacancy rate in Arizona than in the comparison states. And the magnitude of this is consistent with the magnitude of the drop in the unauthorized population. So further evidence, and this is using different data, this is the current population survey, housing vacancy survey. So let me move on to looking at the employment. It fell among Arizona's unauthorized workers. And again, using the same method as we see that the wage and salary employment rate is quite high among non-citizen Hispanics in Arizona and the comparison states, hovering around 80% in the period leading up to the legislation. But starting in 2007, we see this divergent pattern again. So again, strong evidence that employment fell in Arizona, and it coincides with the passing of the legislation. So putting some numbers to what that graph means, our estimates indicate that the percentage of employed non-Hispanic citizens with less education fell about 11 percentage points after the legislation. So this represents about 56,000 workers. We think that these results are not driven by the recession based on, for example, the graph that I showed you, that Arizona has very similar patterns as the comparison states. Importantly is that we don't find any employment effects among competing groups. Okay, so this means that we don't find any evidence yet that Arizona either hurt or benefited competing legal low-skilled workers. And also that we think that the effect that we observe here is stemming primarily from deterrence. That is that it's the E-Verify mandate that's driving it, because again, we don't see that there's been really any substantial number of investigations or really any employers that have been sanctioned yet. There is, importantly, evidence of an unintended consequence of this legislation. And we see that self-employment increased substantially in Arizona among the unauthorized population after the legislation. So again, using the same method as we've used for all these other outcomes that I talked about, we see similar patterns prior to the legislation in Arizona and the comparison states, and then they diverge in the period after the legislation. Self-employment rate among likely unauthorized men, low-skilled, in Arizona doubled in the post-legislation period. And this represents about an increase of 25,000 individuals. So we think that this is an important finding, and it is evidence of this unintended consequence, that this is also associated with, potentially at least, associated with the growth in informal employment, okay, as measured by self-employment. And there are reasons to be concerned about that from a number of perspectives, just from the state's perspective and fiscal perspective, which is obviously something that's very important in these times. It may be that this is associated with lower tax revenues. One, from lower earnings of low-skilled self-employed. In previous work that I've done at PPAC, I find that low-skilled self-employed individuals have lower earners. It's also possible, keeping in mind the population that we're talking about here of unauthorized immigrants, that this shift from wage salary employment into self-employment is also associated with fewer individuals contributing to the tax system as well. Concerns from the perspective of the individuals, not just from the earnings perspective, but it's also possible that it's associated with benefits. It may be associated with fewer basic rights and protection, and quite possibly that it's associated with worsened working conditions. So there are a number of reasons to be concerned about this observation and what we find. But let me wrap up and conclude with and summarize what we've found here in this study. The 2007 legal Arizona Workers Act clearly had an impact on the unauthorized immigrant population in Arizona. The data and our research shows a substantial drop in wage and salary employment among unauthorized population. Again, unauthorized by non-citizen Hispanics. There's evidence of an unintended consequence that a large number of unauthorized immigrants have been pushed out of employment but into self-employment, and there are related concerns with this observation. A couple of points that I think we need to make here is that it did take place. These results we do not think are driven by the recession, but it's also important to recognize that in a growing economy, which we hope to see in the near future, that these results and the magnitude might actually be different. Okay? So as employers are really looking to hiring new workers, what are the results going to be then? How, what the magnitudes will be might be different, and I'll be happy to talk about that later on. It's also important to recognize that there are only three, as far as we can tell, employers that have been sanctioned so far. Over time, if employers are learning that there are no penalties to hiring unauthorized immigrants, it's questionable that they would really react to these kind of legislation. And we're really back to where we were, starting with 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. And so that's something that we also need to keep in mind.
Okay. Thank you.
We've had a slight audio break. Here now is Bruce Morrison, former U.S. Congressman from Connecticut and chair of the House Immigration Subcommittee and former member of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform.
What to make of it, and one should be careful not to kind of get too much into the weeds here. There's clearly some substantial effects that have been found, and talking about those substantial effects and what we think about those is important, more important than trying to measure exactly what the magnitude is or spend too much time if we got the numbers exactly right. I think the most important thing, though, is to put this in a policy context, because I mean that's all information is good for at the end of the day. We don't want information just to have, we want information to help guide what we do. And here, I think this is a very good area. I think the fact that the Center for Immigration Studies has already announced that this is the proof that attrition works, is a demonstration that anybody who has a point of view will be able to find something in this data that they'll be able to use. The finding that people will go off the books was actually foreshadowed by the Joint Tax Committee, which scored Mail-E-Verify as a $17 billion revenue loss on that theory. So if you don't want mandatory E-Verify, here's the proof for that. So there's a lot here, and so having this information can either be a tool for those who've already made up their mind about what this is all about and what we should be doing to say, see, it's proved, or it can guide us in solving a problem, to tell us things that are likely to happen, things that are going to be effects, and it doesn't change the normative debate, but it can guide those who are trying to get to a particular place on things to do to mitigate the downside risks of doing things wrong. And I think it's worth spending a little bit of time on why it is that we have the E-Verify program, why it is we have what's called employer sanctions, and what that, what we should think about those things. I've lived through an awful lot of that process. And I would note there's one line in the report that has nothing much to do with anything except that I took personal offense, in which it said that the last major immigration reform was the 1986 Immigration Act, and having been the author of the 1990 Act, that a little bit offensive, but I actually want to pick at that for a different reason, and because I think it reflects something that has gone terribly wrong with our immigration debate, and that is that the only thing we think about is unauthorized immigration, and the only thing we think needs to be solved is to legalize or expel those people who are here in unauthorized status. And those people who are people, and they're very important in their own right to be talked about as people, but they are a result of the failure of an immigration policy that is supposed to bring people here legally and exclude people who we don't choose to bring here legally. And that's the real frame for the debate. And I think that, maybe I'm just overreacting to this, but I do think this is that so much of our discussion seems to devolve to what do we do about the problem of unauthorized presence, as opposed to what do we do to get our system back on a legal immigration framework, and what does that framework look like, and how do we ensure that that's true. And so it's in that context that I think the conversation about employment verification at the work site should be a prevention conversation as opposed to an enforcement conversation. And I guess the language of that people used in 1986 was employer sanctions, and the notion of punishing people for doing hire of unauthorized workers. But the fact is that, once again, as demonstrated what's going on in Arizona, no one gets sanctioned for knowing hires of unauthorized in large numbers, because the criminal law and the criminal enforcement process and the proof of knowing hire is going to be always a high burden and very difficult. And if we think of this as getting the employers who are bad, then we will never get anywhere on this subject. This is a prevention. And of course, there's evidence of deterrence. I was going to say one of the questions is deterrence of whom? Is this deterrence of employer behavior, or is this deterrence of employee application? And I'm not going to bother to apply in Arizona anymore because of E-Verify, so I don't know who's being deterred, but I would suppose it's deterrence of both that we're seeking. We're and And 1986, if looked at as employer sanctions, is a failure because employers haven't generally been sanctioned. For a while, they were sanctioned a lot about paperwork. Now they're having their paperwork examined, not being sanctioned, but just being required to fire people who then go get more sophisticated phony documentation in order to stay employed. But the real value of 1986 is not a worthless decision by the United States. We decided, the Congress decided, on behalf of the people of the United States, that two things. One, that unauthorized presence was highly correlated with the ability to be employed. And secondly, that we would say you can't be employed in the United States. You shouldn't be employed, and employers are not allowed to employ someone who is here without authorization. And that policy decision is all that's needed. That really crossed the Rubicon. That was a big deal. And it wasn't important that employers are going to be locked up and dragged away. And far too much of this debate is the imagery, and that's somewhat in the raids imagery and paper raids and all the rest, that the job here is to get the bad guy employers and then the problem is solved. This is not a debate about bad guys and good guys. This is a debate about economic incentives and what's going to happen if you allow economic incentives to operate. If economic incentives operate, people are going to chase the economic opportunity, and borders will be seen as an inconvenience in the path of such behavior. And if you can't make the inconvenience so great that you are unlikely to get a job, then this all fails. So I think it would be very useful if we could move this discussion about what to do about unauthorized presence to two things. One is stopping the future condition of more people coming rather than attrition. In other words, prevention means let's acknowledge that we've screwed it up pretty badly, that there are a large number of people here in unauthorized status. That's a product of a lot of decisions and non-decisions and actions and non-actions that have been taken by the society as a whole and by individuals. We can beat each other up endlessly about who to blame and who to punish, or we could decide that we actually would like the future to be different from the past, and the future would be one where there was a very high barrier to employment in the United States if you were unauthorized, and therefore you shouldn't come. And I think the failure to focus that way will be the failure to get a solution if we debate who to punish and who's at fault. And I don't think that you know, rests on one side or another of the debate. I think that's all over the debate. So what that means is that this tool, if you accept my idea that that's really our goal, and that so we have a goal of saying, what do we do moving forward? What can we do moving forward? And I actually think, as a politician, that the public is much more interested in that we've solved the problem going forward than they are in body counts about the past. And I don't think our public policy circumstances in Washington have anything to do with solving problems for the future and have everything to do with body counts from the past, and that's how we run our elections, and I think that's a very sad state of affairs, and it isn't limited to immigration. But if we're going to do that, then we have certain things that we have to deal with, and some of them are covered in this report. This idea of off-the-books employment is clearly a real problem, as this study suggests, and it's intuitively a real problem, and it could be used to throw up our hands and say we can't solve the problem because if people, we do this on an employer compliance basis, and then we will, if we do this on an employer compliance basis, we'll just get, independent contractors. And we already have a problem in this country of independent contractor status substituting for employment in situations which are not really appropriate to independent contractor relationships. So what that says to me is that anything we do, there is an enforcement element of this, but it's not what we're going to ask employers to do on a routine basis. What we're going to ask employers to do on a routine basis is equivalent to what we ask employers to do when we ask them to collect people's taxes. We don't ask them whether they like the tax laws or they don't like the tax laws. We don't make this anything about their quality as an employer. We just tell them to deduct the money and send in the check. And that's compliance. And that's, nobody calls that enforcement. Enforcement is when the employer doesn't do that. And there's another aspect of employment, and that is when an employer, and this is true in the tax context as well, when an employer chooses to have somebody treated as an independent contractor rather than an employee in order to avoid the burden of having to collect the taxes and pay Social Security and do things of that sort. And this is exactly the same situation here in that realm. We need to enforce those kinds of laws, that is the avoidance of a scheme, a structure that says in an employment relationship you have to check whether the person is authorized to work in just the same way as you would have checked their tax status with their W-4, and you have to withhold, you know, you have to, and you can't get around that by changing their status or otherwise undermining the labor laws. What that means is that if anybody's really serious about this, about solving this problem of unauthorized employment and the magnet effect of the unauthorized employment and unauthorized entry and overstay, you need to really beef up a labor law enforcement in the worksite, which has all kinds of positive reasons to occur for American citizens as well as people who are not here legally. So it's a good thing, but I hear very little discussion about that in the context of doing this. And perhaps, you know, nobody wants to scare the employers by telling them that that we might enforce the labor laws, but I would hope that there are two classes of employers in the United States, one who generally obey, who think that they make their business model around getting around the law, and I hope that there are enough of the former so that we can try to get rid of the latter, but we'll see. But I think that's an important part that comes out, important, you know, that's underscored by what's in this report. Now, the only other thing I really want to say before I stop and let this be a discussion is that that E-Verify is a good idea in need of lots of further work. Perhaps I think it's a good idea because it was one of the first things that the Commission on Immigration Reform recommended, that is to have an electronic verification scheme in order to try to overcome what had become the big flaw in the 1986 regime, which was the I-9 and the fraudulent documents problem. Perhaps obvious to everybody but me in 1986, but I think that there's too much thinking that that was all a ploy in 1986, as opposed to we didn't really know in 1986 how sophisticated the counterfeiting regime would become quite quickly. I mean, in those days, you couldn't really Xerox a dollar bill and make it look like a real dollar bill, but it wasn't long after that you could. So in any case, whatever the reason for that, that clearly was the flaw in the verification was the remedy, but we all know that the remedy to electronic verification is imposters and identity theft. So, you know, there's another level here that we've learned about, and E-Verify is helpless in the face of identity theft, and the photo tool is a joke. And Westat, who studied the program for the program, told them that the photo tool is a joke and they should stop spending money on it. And they should stop spending money on it and spend something, money on something that would work, which is real authentication of identity. And you may use biometrics, and there are other ways to get at it, but you got to get at it. And if you don't get at it, you ought to scrap the whole tool, because that will just be 1986 all over again. So there is work to be done on E-Verify. It's not a bad idea. It's far from effective. The other thing I comment that's in the data, you talk about high use of E-Verify at 25%. I think another thing that DHS should have done, given the Arizona law, was go to Arizona and get every employer enrolled to demonstrate they actually have the capacity to enroll every employer. This is, I've said this to the people at the program, and they've turned it aside. I mean, many of the problems here is that nobody wants to face up to the real challenges of implementation of an E-Verify program that works. And we can definitely see that one that's sort of marginal but bigger than anywhere else has a real effect. And we have to do two things. We have to recognize this marginality and figure out how we're going to change that. And secondly, we have to see the unintended consequences of the other problems and react to them. That's all assuming that somebody actually wants to prevent unauthorized entries and overstays and create a legal immigration regime. I happen to think that's like central to the future of the country and ought to be really important and ought not to be a political football. But I'm old enough to know that political footballs are much more popular than problem solving. So thank you.
Great. Well, thank you to Magnus and Sarah and Congressman Morrison. I'm just going to very quickly add a couple of comments, and then we'll open it up for discussion. I want to echo Bruce's observation that you know, I also consider E-Verify very promising and a work in progress, and point out that it was going to be today, but it's actually Monday. I've been told that they are implementing this self-check procedure, which I think is another potentially very important identification tool that MPI, that Doris and I wrote about back in 2009, and so I'm very excited to see how that's going to work and encourage folks who live in D.C. and Virginia to do self-check on yourself. There's five other states, I think, starting on Monday, including D.C. and Virginia, so it gives you an opportunity to go into the system and see if you can be cleared through E-Verify. So I just want to make a couple of comments about the paper as well. You know, as a social scientist, I'm going to push back just a little bit on sort of the core finding that, you know, as Magnus put it in his presentation today, there's been a 17% reduction in the likely unauthorized population due to LAWA. I would state the finding that the likely unauthorized population in Arizona has dropped 17% more in Arizona since 2007 than in the comparison states. And the distinction I want to make is that there's a lot going on in Arizona in addition to LAWA and in addition to E-Verify. So we can't pin all of this on E-Verify. During the same period, you've had every county in Arizona sign up for 287G. More recently, they've all joined secure communities, although I think that's actually past the time of the analysis. But you've had a huge increase in border enforcement. You've had Sheriff Joe on TV. And even though they controlled for Maricopa County, I think, you know, Sheriff Joe effect extends beyond Maricopa County, probably to the whole state. And, you know, just generally, it's such a heightened environment there that it's hard to tease out exactly what's E-Verify, exactly what's LAWA, and what's this more general phenomenon of state-led enforcement and heightened immigration enforcement in general. That doesn't take away from the paper at all, actually. I think that it makes it, you know, in a way, it's sort of maybe a more important or as interesting a finding that this overall increase in enforcement and, you know, state-led effort has contributed to these findings. So teasing out exactly what's E-Verify, exactly what's LAWA, and what's the rest of it is challenging, and they've, you know, they've done some things to control for it, but I think probably the finding is beyond E-Verify and beyond LAWA. I also think that I just want to, you know, we talked a bit before, but I want to redirect our attention to the complicated relationship between immigration enforcement and the economic downturn and migration outcomes, which, you know, are mutually reinforcing. Arizona was between 2000 and 2006 the third fastest growing state in the country in terms of personal income, and between 2008 and 2010 it was the 45th fastest growing state in the country. And I don't think that's mostly because of LAWA. I think it's mostly because of the housing crash, but the effect of the economic downturn on immigration and then of immigration enforcement on the economic downturn is complicated, and the paper acknowledges that, but it's something for us to think about, and it's something for us to think about moving forward as we consider, you know, what good policy options are and how attractive is it that Arizona, that there are 56,000 likely unauthorized immigrants who have lost jobs and no natives who have moved into those jobs, according to the analysis, as a result. So, you know, under a sort of direct reading of the paper, immigration enforcement has eliminated 50,000 jobs in Arizona that haven't been replaced. And, you know, turning that up, I'm not sure that that's, you know, the recipe for economic recovery. And of course, the effects of enforcement extend far beyond whatever effects there are on the economy. And you know, this is not a criticism of the paper, but just thinking about what the policy implications are, we may be concerned about what effect it has on communities and families and on immigrants who we may believe can make a good case for legalization. So just to echo Bruce's comment, I think it's very important to distinguish between policy tools that aim at preventing future unauthorized immigration and policy tools that aim at addressing the 11 million unauthorized immigrants who are here. And it's likely the case that we would recommend different tools to address those different problems. And they very often get conflated in the debate. And it's not at all clear that something like mandatory E-Verify is the best tool for reducing the existing population versus preventing future unauthorized immigration. So we should think about, we should always make sure to distinguish between those. And then one other point that I'll make, just because we've been talking about numbers, is on the underground economy, I think this is one of the most interesting and important findings, and a really important and creative way to measure unauthorized employment through self-employment. And the finding that it doubled, I think, is, you know, it's a big number. It also likely understates the actual trend in unauthorized employment, because many people who are in underground employment, because many people who are moving underground aren't reporting self-employment, they're just moving out of the tax system altogether. So the actual finding, I mean, the actual trend is probably even larger than what they found. I'm going to, unless you have a burning desire to respond to one of us, maybe we'll get a few comments and start the conversation that way. And let me, before people, let me ask you to wait for the microphone, and when it gets to you, to hold it nice and close to your mouth, unless you speak really loudly like me, in which case you can hold it a little farther, and to say who you are and where you come from. Yeah, Lisa's bringing you the mic up here.
I speak quite loudly also. Thank you very much. My name is Angela Martini, and I work for the European Commission in Brussels on immigration issues, but I'm currently teaching at the School of Public Policy of George Mason University. And I have a couple of questions going back to your conclusions. And one is precisely about the raise in self-employment, which it always comes up, you know. But you said that there was a drop in 17%, which I don't understand what is a 17% drop in overall population or 17% more compared to other states. That's following your comment, you know. but overall, there's been a decline in the population. So in a way, even if the self-employment, and I do agree with you that there is only a margin of probably the actual effect, is still quite limited, because a lot of that population, I mean, just disappeared from Arizona, if I understand correctly. So there was a sharp increase in the population overall. So even if part of that shifted into this sort of self-employment, is still quite limited. It's not 17% that shifted into that, because there was a decline in the population. So maybe a bit more elaboration on that particular point in terms of quantifying a bit. And the second point, and I don't know whether your research addressed that population that declined, is there any indication of whether they moved to other states or move back home, you know? And in a way, you shift, you know, the problem is like when you put the dust under the carpet, you know? you put it, I mean, you remove it from here, but then it goes out, so you haven't really addressed the issue. The third point, I mean, I'm going to take a bit, because I'm very interested in that, is that in the European Union, we have adopted, I don't know whether you're familiar, we have legislation at state level, and we have legislation at sort of at EU level, a bit here. We adopted 2 years ago also legislation of employer sanctions. Some member states already had it. It's been sort of made as a rule at the EU level. Sanctions vary because we cannot precisely indicate the sanctions because it's a competence of the member state. And one of the points, and I would like to understand better how it works here, was not only to tackle illegal migration, for sure, but also to tackle the fact that underground economy or informal economy, because in Europe we have a much more developed system of verifying identities and carrying passport, much more police state, if you want. For us it's normal that, you know, Big Brother, you know, is there, it's part of our daily lives. But it was also to avoid exploitation of these people, because what happens is that when you employ undocumented migrants, you know perfectly they're undocumented, so you don't pay taxes on them, they don't get social security, they don't pay welfare. So in a way it was double-edged action, tackling illegal migration, but also in a way protecting that these people wouldn't get exploited, because there have been quite a lot of cases of exploitation. So I want to understand what it's a similar situation. And then maybe the last comment coming to Bruce Morrison's comment, I do agree. I mean, in a way, addressing illegal migration, documented migration, requires a policy mix of so many measures, and you can create unwarranted consequences. But opening channels for legal migration, it certainly can contribute, but it won't solve the problem. We see that in Europe, we don't have many channels for legal migration. We are very bad at that, and that is one point for sure. But people come nevertheless, even if they don't have the economic incentive, even if they don't find a job, we at least, maybe in Europe, we are facing a different kind of situation. People come because there is a lot of push factors. There is not only a pull factor, like you have a job opportunity here, there is no sanction, and then, you know, you come here because you're going to find a job. People come nevertheless because the push factors especially are so strong that they don't care whether they find a job or not. And that is also what creates a lot of problems in addressing, because you can create channels, you can have measures to prevent, but people will continue to come nevertheless. And that what creates a lot of tension in societies, because people end up in marginalized margins of the society. They don't find jobs, opportunity. And that is what makes it very difficult, especially at European level, where the market, labor market is much less flexible. And so it makes it very, very difficult. Thank you. Sorry for being so long.
Let's start to tackle these questions. And probably the easiest one is the clarification. So what we find is a 17% drop in the unauthorized population. So there is a decline of about 92,000 unauthorized immigrants as measured by this non-citizen Hispanics. That's a decline in the population that we tie to the legislation. It is, you know, relative to the comparison states, but given our efforts, we think that that's mostly due to the legislation. When it comes to employment, now we're talking about the population that remains in Arizona. So there we find this 11 percentage point drop in employment. So that's the shift into, those are 56,000 fewer jobs for the unauthorized in Arizona. And then there's this substantial increase in self-employment. We'll have a doubling of the self-employment rate from 8 to about 16%, and that represents about 25,000 workers. So I hope that. The second issue, And this ties into a number of other comments by Mark and Bruce, and that is, how did this drop in 92,000, give or take, come about? It can come about from, as you point out, they can move to other states, can move back to their home country or another country for that matter as well. And those are possible ways that you can reduce the population. But importantly, it's also by reducing the inflow. Okay, and it could be inflow from the source country, whatever country we're thinking about, or it can be from other states as well. We did look at this as well, and it's a little bit more challenging than the outcomes that we were looking at, because we're looking at migration, and it's a relatively low probability event. But in the data that we have, and there are limitations, it suggests that the reduction is primarily driven by a reduction in the inflow. Okay. And I think that's important because it ties into Mark's and Bruce's comments as well. What I think E-Verify might do, it's not necessarily a drop in the population of those who are in that particular state or country. It reduces that incentive to move there. And so it's the inflows that we think is probably more important. And your third comment was about employee sanctions in Europe and the shift to underground economy. And this is hugely important. And this is kind of like the first step indicating that we do have some evidence that mandates and legislation like this may lead to that as well. At this point, and maybe frustratingly, we're not providing solutions how to address that. But it's raising that issue as well, and that's been our objective with this research. How to go about it is a challenging issue. It's well known in Europe how challenging it is, and it's something that we need to be aware of here as we move forward in addressing these issues.
Let me comment. I mean, Europe has much larger informal employment systems than the U.S. U.S. is low regulation, and therefore most people are under it. But significant differences. So that makes a significant difference in which problem we have and how big it is. The push, first of all, there's no one solution to the immigration problems. It has to be a coordinated set of policies as opposed to what we have now, an uncoordinated set of unsuccessful policies. So that's clearly correct. But I'd say two things about the pull-push, so the distinction you drew. First of all, you can't survive in the United States without employment as well as you can in Europe. I mean, you've got nanny states, and we have whatever the opposite of a nanny state is. The only thing you get if you're unauthorized in the United States is if you're really sick, you can show up at a hospital and get treated for just what it is that, you know, puts you in extremis, and you can send your children, whether authorized or not, to school. And beside that is almost nothing. And you pretty much, unless you have a benefactor, you'll starve. More importantly, your so-called push factors are all embedded in an asylum regime, and you are very generous. Now, Doris Meisner, who's sitting there, put a big stake in the heart of our having that problem when she was commissioner of INS, and that was we also used to have a situation where you could show up in the United States, present an asylum application, and disappear into the population. We now put those people in Doris's regime wasn't quite as draconian as it's become over the years. But the point was that there was deterrence for that. That is, if you wouldn't be able to just slip off into the population, that you could dramatically change those numbers. And in fact, those numbers were dramatically changed in a rather short period of time. We don't have big asylum populations here. People are detained for long periods of time. It's really an awful thing to do to come. And therefore, of course, legitimate asylum applicants are often mistreated in order to get at the problem of all the fraudulent asylum applications. So I think the push factor can be dealt with, although it takes fairly strong measures, and some people won't have the stomach for those measures.
So Scott Borger, Office of Immigration Statistics. So one of my concerns was that an alternative explanation. So it seems somewhat intuitive that the LAWA could have had this impact on the population. An alternative explanation, though, is that the difficulty of, so in the population, the unenumerated, the people that aren't, are the error rate in who we don't observe in the sample that we think should be there is constant. And it's possible that all the rhetoric that was happening in Arizona made people more reluctant to actually respond to surveys. And so it's actually possible that that the error rate is actually changing as a response to, not the error rate, but the unenumerated rate is changing in response to the rhetoric. And so it's not that the people actually left, it's that they're much less likely to actually report to the survey. Micro surveys that are doing this have described this, and with incredible effort to get people to actually report in surveys in the United States because of that fear factor. the MMFR pre-program is a good example of that. I was aware of some of their work, the difficulties that they would have. And so if that's the case, then it's possible that this drop in population are just that they've gone further underground, so it's a different concern. And B, because of the economic conditions, there is also evidence that migrants are doing different things to cope with the economic situations, including, although not leaving, they're combining households, they're combining food, different things like that. And so you could actually see some of that drop in the increase in the rental vacancy rate as due to those adjustments, not just due to the change in the population, underlying population.
The survey response is something that we were concerned about, just given the fact that even in regular times or in all states, that there is underreporting in certain populations. One thing that we did to try to comfort ourselves that we're getting a relatively consistent population is to look at some of the characteristics reported by those in the survey before and after LAWA over the period that we're looking at. And we didn't find any noticeable trends. Like, you would be really concerned if it was a select type of people who stopped responding to the survey, and that could really drive especially our employment outcomes. But we didn't really find any evidence in that in terms of overall composition of those who respond to the survey. As to getting at the population drop.
I think it's, your points are really, those are good points and concerns. And it is also, as Sarah pointed out, we're very aware of those issues. And that is why we're looking at other outcomes, other data sources as well. And the rental vacancy does a really good job of that. Now you don't have those kind of problems, we don't think. And importantly, and I'll come back to the economic conditions in a second. And importantly, what we estimate are the population effects, how many left, and assuming that a high proportion of these are renters as opposed to homeowners, which I don't think is really a far stretch. The increase in the rental vacancy rate is completely consistent with those magnitudes as well. So that gives us, an additional degree of comfort in what we're saying here. In terms of the economic conditions, I agree that that's quite possible that immigrants, maybe particularly low-skilled immigrants, are reacting to these hard economic conditions maybe differently than the native population. But remember that we're using comparison states. There are immigrants who are hurting in these states as well, and the economy, our data suggests that they're hurting those states as well. So you would expect to see that in those other states as well. So that kind of comparison, the difference in difference approach should address that as well.
I noticed you had Utah and New Mexico that didn't have the same effect that Nevada did. I would be curious to know if your comparison state with Nevada was as stark as the others.
I don't think, group. Right. Okay, so just looking at Nevada. At our early stages, we might have just done, state by state. The concern is that, first of all, Arizona is a small state. Nevada is a very small state as well. So it now you're introducing a lot of uncertainty and possibility of not being able to tie down the effects as precisely. So I don't know. There's certainly a possibility to go and look at that as well.
Juan Poderos at the Urban Institute. I'm really interested in small states. I'm wondering if you had, because a lot of states are going to be looking at this report and have been looking to Arizona. I'm thinking of policy leaders and legislators as an example about what to do. And I'm thinking specifically of two states that have had more resilient economies than any of the states you talked about, including Utah, New Mexico, and Nevada, and that's Nebraska, which did pass a public benefits law a few years ago. But more importantly, a state that I'm more familiar with, and I've done similar kinds of things, although not as detailed, in Oklahoma. Now, both of those states' immigrant populations are far smaller than Arizona, so you've got issues there. But I'm wondering if you were giving a presentation on this report in front of the Nebraska or the Oklahoma legislatures, full of their leaders and their people who know what's going on the ground, would you change how you're presenting your findings to reflect the fact that you're looking at places with less resilient economies? And what might you say to a place like Oklahoma or Nebraska?
That's a great question. Analyzing these outcomes in a small state or a single state is difficult on its own, which is why we had to use a variety of methods to try to really pinpoint what was going on in Arizona. But at least in Arizona, there's a large immigrant population in which there's the scope to empirically find a result. In Oklahoma or Nebraska, I think we would expect like the similar types of outcomes, although the magnitudes, it would be hard to predict, I think. In any single state, a law like LAWA leaves an immigrant with many options at this point. They can move to, you know, almost 49 other states. And especially in maybe a place like these states that you mentioned.
What if I told you that in Oklahoma, you actually have the reverse?
Here's the mic. What if I told you that in Oklahoma, you have the reverse kinds of outcomes in terms of people staying, people still coming into the state, birth statistics, school enrollment, migration data from the ACS and other, because I really like the fact that you use multiple data sources and I believe your results. But what if I told you that in Oklahoma, we see a different story? How might you place the study into that context?
Sounds to me like you've already hinted at why it's different. It's the resilient economy of those states. So I think what's important here is then to bring our results into a situation where you have a stable, maybe growing economy and think about what the results might be. And it's not clear exactly what the impact will be. On one hand, in a growing or resilient economy, what you have are employers who are looking to hire, right? And if there is an E-Verify mandate and they are actually using it, then that's going to have a big bite, right? So it would have a stronger impact than what we might see in Arizona during the recession period. So, but that's under the assumption that they are actually enrolled and participating in the E-Verify program, right? They also have an incentive in a growing economy not to do that. And this comes back to what Bruce was saying, the importance. If you are going to have an E-Verify mandate, is to encourage and maybe legislate that employers are actually enrolled in the program. And once you've done that, now you can say more about what those impacts are. If you're successful in getting them in there in a growing economy, those effects would potentially be larger than what we would observe in Arizona. A lot of ifs there.
My name is Joe Freeman. I'm a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Institute. Presumably that law was passed because the legislature perceived there being a lot of cost from unauthorized immigrants. Do you have any data on whether or not those costs have gone down, such as, for example, emergency room admissions or anything else?
I saw one more question here. I guess, are there any other questions? Is this the last question? We'll get one more question from Doris after this, and then we can answer those questions and let people have their final say.
Hello, thank you for your presentations and comments. I'm Yevan Noturno with the Interactivity Foundation working on Human Migration Project. And that's given what you said about the lessons learned from this law and your comments about immigration debate in the country, I would like to ask what concerns and policy possibilities you think would be the most useful for U.S. public to discuss, not so much policymakers as public, to consider and discuss. Thank you.
Doris Meissner at MPI. I'm wondering whether you can give us any insights. Did the research show you anything about what kinds of employers did and did not? Talking about a mandatory law that would be prospective, in other words, new hires coming into the system. And I think that LAWA requires employers' existing labor forces be checked. It is just new hire. Okay, so then it actually is, analogous. So what kinds of employers signed up?
Lisa, maybe, is there one more question up here in the front? I'm sorry.
From your research, you mentioned one of the, I'm Bob Farron from Verification Division. You mentioned one of your factors was going to be no impact on naturalized foreign borns. And the question I would ask is, did you do any studies as to any increase or decrease in that population, as in many cases, naturalized citizens are either in a family unit with or aligned with unauthorized immigrants as well, or workers.
I guess, why don't, maybe if you guys want to answer questions and then you can each have some brief closing comments.
Do you want to?
I can take the last question.
All right.
Go in reverse order. We didn't find any evidence, statistical evidence, that there was an impact on the naturalized population or the native-born population that are similar to unauthorized in terms of their ethnicity or their level of skill. However, something, getting to your question about maybe mixed status households, in our population effects, Magnus mentioned during the presentation that we find the strongest evidence for population declines among the working age male population. And we don't find the same strong results for older, potentially longer in the U.S. Unauthorized immigrants, which may suggest that those with stronger ties, local ties, maybe due to the fact that they have native-born children, are less likely to respond, especially to migrate in response to a legislation like this.
The first question of other costs, the cost of unauthorized and how it might have changed in Arizona, we haven't looked at that yet. I think it is one of the many outcomes you'd want to take a look at next is how the state of Arizona was affected in other ways, and including maybe the cost and healthcare, education, and whatever else. We have not looked at that yet. Also, on Dory's question, unfortunately, we don't have any insight to who did enroll and who did not, and I'm not sure how. If there is publicly available data, it will actually allow you to say something more about it and what industries, for example, and under what conditions, the size of them, and so forth. We really don't know at this point.
We have that data. Actually, we can look at the table later. I'll just quickly comment. I think this question raised at the front about the questions that the public discussion should be focusing on. Possibly as distinct from the policy or from the policymakers' discussion. I just want to comment that things like the costs of unauthorized migration are a great example of where the public discussion is misinformed. For reasons that Bruce pointed out earlier. There's this perception that unauthorized immigrants are this huge drain on resources, when in fact unauthorized immigrants have access to very few public benefits. So certainly having a more informed discussion and a better understanding of costs and benefits and, thinking about the real costs of enforcement, both the economic costs and the broader social costs and what costs we as a society are willing to bear to drive out unauthorized immigrants, or when we think that the legalization is a better alternative. And again, just to think differently about dealing with the problems that we have versus looking into the future, I think are things for that discussion.
Well, it would be nice to think that we could move the conversation to a sort of a problem-solving place and a sense of what we would like America to look like 50 years from now, and that would be, that would be good. I won't bother to try to answer that question more than that, just because I don't know any public policy matter that we are in this country problem-solving people as opposed to beating up each other every day on radio and TV and a problem that if anybody is putting money into or working on, they shouldn't be focusing on a particular subject matter. We have, we've taken our democracy and put it in a very fragile place because we just don't talk about this in a civil way, like we care about our country more than we care about getting our own way. And if we don't change that, we're going down.
Well, on that cheery note, thank you again for coming, and please feel free to come up and chat with us more.
For more information, visit www.migrationpolicy.org/